Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 24, brought to you by Chaos Group. In this episode, we talk to Paul DeBevec. And Paul DeBevec is a good friend of mine, obviously. I've got a lot of good friends in the industry. And I've known Paul for many, many years. And he's also a member of the Digital Human League and working on the WikiHuman project, where we just released the data for Digital Emily. Lily's my daughter. She's with me today because she's not doesn't even have school. Lily, what do you know about Digital Emily?
Well, I thought she was kind of cool, but at first she looked a little weird, and then it got better and better and better and better and better.
Really? So why did she look weird? So you know what they call that when something looks weird like that? Did it look creepy?
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
There was something missing in it. I don't remember what, but there was something missing in it.
Yeah.
That I thought she really needed.
Yeah, that thing that makes it look creepy is called the Uncanny Valley. And in fact, we talk about the Uncanny Valley in this podcast with Paul. And we also talk about actually Paul in general and about his entire history, the history of the light stages, which is huge. It ends up being actually a fairly long podcast and a very technical one for those who really like technical stuff. And we also talk obviously about the WikiHuman project and a few other things, including the ideas of the importance of working on digital humans. So it was really fun. I hope you enjoy it all, and thanks a lot.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Do you remember the first time that we met? Do you remember where that was? Because I do.
you might have to remind me,
but it was point, it was
at some SIGGRAPH party or
no, it was at Martini Night at DD.
Oh, awesome! Very cool, very cool. Those were great. They had the little grass hut, and it was every Friday, right?
Yep. And I just started chatting with you. I was like, oh my god, it's Paul DeBevec, because I one of the biggest reasons I got so passionate about lighting was because of the stuff I saw both for the Campanile project and then obviously Fiat Lux. That was it. I was sold. I was convincing everyone. This is back when I was still in architecture. I said, we are no longer going to be using lights, like point lights to light architecture. It's going to be something new. It's going to be image-based lighting with HDRs. And they're like, yeah, maybe. And they just didn't believe it. So, you know, I'm just saying it. I called it. So. I remember seeing that and I say, oh, it's Paul. And I went to talk to you and you were starting to work on your Pantheon project.
Parthenon. Yep.
Right.
And then I ended up having you and was an Estrus Vargas come in, and then you guys actually, you know, consulted and, you know, helped with, you know, some, you know, shot selection, camera motion. And
right.
So it just basically showed you the project and asked for your input.
That's exactly it. It was kind of a unique position. I didn't know I was going to be in, where basically you said, oh, you know, I've done this great project and we were just there to see the project. And it's like, I'd love your input. And I was like, how can I make the animation flow better? And so we sort of gave you some input, which was great. And it came out really beautiful.
Thank you.
And I guess that was the first time I'd learned about unlighting textures, which was really kind of interesting as
well. Yeah, the inverse global illumination process.
Taking out all shadows and all anything that would be influencing it. And then after that, you basically convinced Estrus and I to go to Spain with you.
For the Mundos Digitalis conference, right, which by the way is coming up in early July.
Yeah.
MundosDigitalis.org, I think.
Yep.
Run by Manuel Mejide, who puts on an amazing event every summer in A Coruña, Spain, and they get the cool speakers from animation and visual effects, and they all talk about their latest cool stuff. So that was a good time. I think I went last year and it was a good time. I'm not going this year. I like to go like every other year to these things if possible, because then I'm much more likely to have good new stuff to show.
Right. Well, you do go to a lot of conferences, but I'm sure you have a lot of good stuff to show. That was my first time going there. And I think that was my first time speaking at any event.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You did a great job.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it. But I think one thing that was very clear to me, because what I've always liked about what you do, I've always liked what you do, but what I've really always appreciated, and I've mentioned this a few times, is you present very complicated material in a way that is very discernible to almost any audience. And you make it very nice and digestible for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people, when they're presenting very complicated things, sometimes they feel like they want to present it as being very complicated to be impressive in its complexity. And that's not fair to the audience.
So, I mean, I've definitely seen presentations where some useful technique gets presented as if there's entire page of equations.
Right.
There. I've had papers submitted to SIGGRAPH, which were ultimately accepted, where actually I didn't have a single equation in the paper until I realized, wow, wait, we're running a risk here having no equations in the paper. We better think of something that needs an equation.
Right.
At this point, and then you add one and think of it like, there's some reason to put the rendering equation in there. There's always some reason for that. That's a good equation. If you know one equation, it should be the rendering equation. I think that's – well, the only way that, you know, you can be an intellectually capable individual, because I don't think anybody has fundamentally more brain capacity than another person. It's just you have to organize your information mm-hmm. better. And so what you have to do is reduce things down to the simplest possible thing of what's actually going on.
Yep.
Which consists of, you know, actually understanding it. And then you've got room for lots of stuff because everything becomes relatively simple. And I'm not good at keeping particularly complicated things in my head. So
right.
I have to simplify them if I want to keep track of them. And then yep. if I'm presenting something, then I want to do the simplified version of it. And actually, preparing a presentation is a great way to figure out, okay, what's the simple way
yes,
to do this?
Indeed.
And sometimes in the process of preparing it, I realize, wow, it's actually simpler than I thought.
And so the talk we gave there, because like I said, it was very clear to me. I learned a lot in that process. It was my first big presentation. And the process you did, it was you, me, Estrus, and Dan Lemon was presenting stuff from Lord of the Rings.
Dan, right? Who's been kicking the Rise of the Apes, Dawn of the Apes movies.
Yeah, he's doing it. And he was nominated for an Oscar again this year, I think, right?
Yeah, he's been nominated for, and hopefully he'll win one at some point, because that is some amazing work going on.
Yeah,
over there.
Yeah, really. They're just doing amazing work there. But he, what you made us do, and you made us do it twice before the presentation, is actually rehearse the presentation and go through the timing and make sure that everything flowed and we knew contextually speaking, because all four of us were speaking at once, right? Or not at once, in a row. Mm-hmm. And it was a part of a series. So you want to make sure that everyone heard everyone else's presentation so we could contextualize it together. Mm-hmm. And having gone through the timing a few times, and I learned a lot from that process. So it was very good to understand that. And again, it was that idea of like, explain this in a way that the entire audience is going to learn from it or appreciate it. People who understand it and people who've never heard of this before will both understand what's going on. So I think it was a really good way. And I've always been under the philosophy of simpler is better.
Yeah. I also think, because, I think we're all fans of high dynamic range. I think the quality of a talk or a presentation mm-hmm. is a high dynamic range quantity, as in it can either be really, really bad or it can really be really, really, really high. It's not a 0-1 kind of thing.
Right.
Your talk can almost always be twice as good, and it probably takes twice as much effort to make your talk twice as good. But every idea can have a really nice visual mm-hmm. To it. You don't want to put every single concept that you're speaking about like literally in a slide. It's actually okay and a good thing to have the audience have to visualize and connect the dots and imagine a little bit
right.
As well. But there's some parts of my presentations where I just realize, you know what, if I could find a day and a half to do a better visual for this, it would make, you know, every talk I give from now to eternity like better. And so I got to try to find those times for that.
Well, what were some of your favorite presentations? If you're going to, like, let's say, what was your two or your four or your eight presentation under the HDR scenario?
Well, there was an Academy presentation in April 2010 that was organized by Bill Croyer and Barry Weiss from the Academy SciTech Council.
Yeah.
And this is before I was on the Academy SciTech Council. I'm actually now a co-chair with Craig Barron of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Science and Technology Council, which still not quite sure how that happened. But the thing that they organized was acting in the digital age. And this was inspired by the fact that, you know, we had like Gollum as a major character, kind of a digital actor, Avatar, and Benjamin Button. I think Avatar and Benjamin Button were like the things like, okay, we've got to do an Academy event to talk to the filmmaking community. What is acting in the digital age? What's all this performance capture mean? How does it work? What was going on with Benjamin Button? Mm-hmm. And I really love this thing because, you know, Steve Prieg, another member of the Digital Human League, you know, came on and gave a presentation about his team's work. And, you know, I ended up having to present the work that we had done on the Digital Emily Project and the Curious Case of Benjamin Button, because we helped scan reflectance fields in the light stage of the Benjamin Button maquette. And then it was a huge image-based lighting thing with work by Jonathan Lidd and Paul Lambert over at Digital Domain and just hitting it out of the park with some of the best, you know, IBO lighting reconstruction work that's been done.
Yeah.
Before or since, and then Avatar, because we scanned, you know, most of the principal casts in the high-res facial scanning approach that we've got with the polarized gradient illumination for Avatar. So I had, like, those three things to present. And they told me you've got, like, 10 or 12 minutes, like, max.
Wow.
And, you know, it's the, you know, the standard thing, like Mark Twain's quote that I'm sorry this letter is too long. I didn't have time to write a shorter one. Like, I had to work really, really, really hard to get those three things communicated quickly. And fortunately, I had had a chance to talk about the Digital Emily Project for TEDx USC. It was like the first of the TEDx conferences was held at USC. And I had 5 minutes to explain the Digital Emily Project.
Right.
And that I thought was insane. I have no idea how to do it. And then I came up with a way to tell the story because I had to, and all of a sudden it got so good. And my explanation of what the project actually was and what the achievements were that were relevant just got so much sharper. And the thing that actually made, because I think I did pretty good on that Academy thing in April, is that I'd showed up early. You know, I'd prepared my presentation. There was like a laptop set up there. And I was early enough that I had the entire Samuel Goldwyn Theater to myself about 2 hours before the event started. And I just went and I gave my talk to an empty room 2 hours before. Not right before, but 2 hours before.
And you had to, but it was a 12-minute presentation.
A 12-minute presentation. It didn't take all that long. And as a result, everything had basically faded just right deep enough into my memory. So it wasn't like, I wasn't thinking like, hey, I just said that, so I can't say it again. But I was just ready to say exactly the right thing every time, and it worked out really well. And you know, one of the most special things is also that Emily O'Brien herself actually was able to come to the event. She was almost caught in London like Andy Serkis ultimately was because of the Icelandic volcano that was erupting. And afterwards, they actually got to bring her up and ask her impressions as an actress. What was it like, you know, to be digitized? What is it like to see yourself? How do you feel the digital character did? And getting that perspective, I think, was really valuable for all of the Screen Actors Guild members that were in the audience. So it was just a magical evening for that.
It is really interesting to see actors see their digital selves. The first time I've seen that personally was I was working on iRobot, and Alex Proyas was the director on it, and we've been working on the interrogation scene with Sonny, where it was very, very well. I mean, it was one of our best lighters. We were going to beautifully lit, incredibly well done, and the emotions were really well animated. It was really, really, really well done. Andy Jones was the animation supervisor on it at that time, so he went
on to Avatar and won an Oscar for that.
Yeah, exactly. But Andy, so we presented the final shot, and then Alan Tudyk, the actor, who played.
The robot. Sonny the robot.
He happened to be there, and he showed up, I was like, oh, we want to see your shot. The way that DD worked at the time in the old building is that the main console was in the front, and there was a few buttons to turn on the lights and to turn off the lights that were there. But there was also a big button that was a big red button that you would click, and it would ring a bell. And that would mean that the shot was finaled. Like you, and the director could say, that's a great shot. And they really loved to like cling, 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 cling. They'd final the shot. They were like, done. I'm great, you know.
Every time an angel gets its wings, yeah, or a shot is final.
Or a shot is final, they rang the bell. And they were like, it's like, well, we'll see if Alan wants to final his shot. And he looked at the shot and there was just silence. There was no emotion. We're like, oh, does he hate it or does not? And he was tearing up. He was just... Because he remembered the scene was very emotional, because you had to be emotional because he's being interrogated. He's like, oh, this is a very surreal experience to see yourself.
Hmm.
And he ended up filing his shot, which was kind of exciting. But
wow.
But see, having a reaction like that, because I think, you know, a lot of times, I'm sure like Andy Serkis is pretty used to it by now, but having someone see like their performance being recaptured and done digitally, I think is a little surreal. So
I would think so. I mean, there's a rendering of me floating around now,
yeah.
Or at least my face,
yeah,
not necessarily my head, bald, right? And
yeah.
I've never shaved my head, but the rendering shows me with a shaved head, and that's like kind of amusing, a little creepy,
yeah.
I think. My mom says that that's definitely not the head that she remembers.
No, the head is a little larger, for sure.
So, but yeah, I kind of look like a, you know, that's like the former Marine version of me.
Yeah,
I guess.
You have a bouncer someplace.
Or bouncer, yeah. So this is good. And that's actually great, because if I were an actor, which I'm not, but if I wanted to play a bouncer, that would be cool. I'd still be recognizable as me, but then, you know, all of the other things an actor might do to kind of puff themselves up or seem more authoritative, and that you could augment subtly with the computer graphics.
Right.
And that's where I think this digital actor technology really is going to expand the palette of what actors can do. They can play, you know, younger and older, like we saw in Benjamin Button.
Right.
And those were obviously kind of extreme, but just doing subtle things to people. People do subtle things with lighting and with makeup and how they hold their faces and things they stuff in their mouths in various ways to slightly alter who you are. And that's something that you can just take it a lot further, and you have more control over it after the fact too. Like if you decided to do it this way and then you realize, well, in the edit, it's just not working. We got to kind of re-sculpt that. The head. You can do that for a digital character and still keep the performance.
Right. Well, before we get too much into the digital characters, let's talk about how that started for you. I mean, you started that process with the light stage, right? So your first light stage, from what I remember, was basically a light on a string that you would drop, and you would spin it, and it would drop down, and you would try to capture all these from a single light source. Mm-hmm. You'd have a, it was like a cantilevered light. It would drop down,
yeah.
And you would spin, and you would basically shoot something from all these directions.
That's what that's the first light stage that, you know, actually got built. There were a couple of prototypes before that, or experiments before that.
Sure.
It's actually not the technology that I really wanted to build first. So the story of how the light stages got started is that in 1998, I published a SIGGRAPH paper with a very long title, but ultimately it was about image-based lighting. It was about lighting. It's called Rendering Synthetic Objects into Real Scenes. And it was about, you know, you take an HDR panoramic photo, put that into your global illumination renderer, and then have the renderer collect all the light from the scene through ray tracing, so you get internal reflections and internal bounces and things like that. It's not environment mapping. It's a new thing, which, you know, uses these spherical HDR images. And then it talked about projecting it onto the shape of the room, so the light comes from the right positions in space. Yeah. And it talked about how to get shadows into the scene too, and cast shadows onto the stuff that the new objects are going to be on, with something that we call differential rendering. And I wanted to do that for faces. I wanted to basically do image-based lighting. If I've captured an HDR map someplace, how would I show someone else lit by that?
Right.
And the first thought I had is that, well, I can show it with video projectors. I'd like aim video projectors, you know, all on the walls of a room or something. Mm-hmm. And then that would reflect back on the face.
Right. It's similar to like gravity, what gravity did in a little bit and some of the lighting, but they did with big expensive light panels, right?
Indeed. So that would then, you know, get the right light on the face. And it's very different than aiming the projector at the person.
Right.
Which would be good if you're trying to, you know, put a grid on them, mm-hmm. but they would only light them from that one projector lens position. This is sure. to illuminate a big, you know, wall or part of a sphere with the projector. And I thought maybe I'd like use a fisheye projector. I'd do it on the inside of some curved surface. I was trying to figure this out. And that was going to be my paper for SIGGRAPH 99 mm-hmm. was to do that. And the whole idea of like changing the illumination, putting real-time interactive light on people and compositing them in. And then it just, no practical idea of how to actually pull it off that would have enough light, enough angular coverage, and just get a result that I'd be proud of. Came to pass
sure.
at that point. And instead I got involved in a collaboration on the inverse global illumination process, which was a, you know, a decent paper mm-hmm. for 99 instead. And that, you know, a new version of that's what helped us make the Parthenon movie. But then, okay, SIGGRAPH 2000 is coming around and what's the project? And I still wanted to light faces with HDRI maps. And the idea came about that, well, I can certainly light a person, you know, with a spotlight, and then if I could move the spotlight to every position in the sphere, mm-hmm. that I could then simulate the person lit with the full sphere of light in post.
Right.
And that...
So you would grade each position at its different color.
Yeah. Exactly. So, right. you know, you basically suppose that, you know, we've built light stage one mm-hmm. and we swing the light around and it goes and light stage one actually got 2000 different lighting directions, you know,
okay.
it was, effectively, you know, 64 lighting directions around the equator mm-hmm. and then, 32 directions from the North Pole to the South Pole, mm-hmm. which is about, you know, 2000, still one of the highest resolution light stages ever built and
with one light.
With one light, and at the point I was kind of running out of money at Berkeley, and that's sort of why I eventually had to go get a job at USC, and I actually didn't know how to fund it, so I actually bought all the parts myself and kept the budget under $1,000. So that was the mental problem to solve is how to, you know, in a well-calibrated way, light somebody from every direction that light can come from in a finite amount of time. And so the idea of spiraling the light around with this two-axis gantry... I had the team put a little beep, on it so that every time it went around, it would go beep at like 3,400 kilohertz with some little Radio Shack beeper unit. And then we'd analyze the audio tracks of the mini DV tapes to figure out how fast we actually were rotating mm-hmm. The light. And then, Chris Chu, pulled apart the AVI files and then, you know, retimed it so that we had the same number of lighting directions from the same angles every horizontal rotation.
Right.
In any case, then what you do is that you have an image of what the person looked like from unit intensity white light from every direction on the sphere. And you can add any two lighting directions together and show them what they look like with light from the left plus light from the right or light from above.
Yep. Light
and
is
below.
Additive. Yep.
And a real... lighting environment is going to have different colors and intensities from every direction. So what you do is, you know, you just sample your light probe into a 64 by 32 lat long map that tells you the color and intensity or, you know, the intensity of the red and the green and the blue channels for every direction that you shot with your light stage. You multiply those against your light stage data, you add the whole thing up and voila, it illuminates your actor with the light of that other environment and actually gets the right answer.
Yeah.
So that seemed kind of cool and submitted it to SIGGRAPH. The SIGGRAPH paper actually, we had as a collaborator, Mark Sagar on that. And I had some really, you know, useful discussions with him about how to apply this to animated characters.
Okay.
And the plan originally had been, he'd gone so far as to give us some of the motion capture data from Life Effects of Jessica Valeau, who was the jester in their, you know, important, very cool SIGGRAPH 99 electronic theater piece,
okay.
which was a Very realistic looking character for the time. It was animated with motion capture. It had some finite element simulation for the eyelids and the mouth to get those to animate better. And the reason that one of the main characters in our Light Stage 1 paper is Jessica Vallo is our goal was to actually animate Jessica from her light stage data. So we recorded her from different positions. We mapped onto 3D geometry, put a 3D scanner in there. Mm-hmm. We came up with a diffuse specular separation technique, which Tim Hawkins refined to be better and more data-driven, that could render it from different positions. And then we were actually going to map it onto an animated face. And we got a couple of test renders of that. But by the time the SIGGRAPH paper was due, you know, A, that stuff wasn't really working great yet. And B, our paper was already 12 pages just talking about, you know, building the light stage, doing the image-based relighting, mapping it onto geometry, doing the diffuse specular separation.
Right.
Accounting for bounce light from clothing. I mean, there's way too and polarization tests too. Actually,
and that's how you start to separate your
diffuse specular separation based on polarization mm-hmm. was something that we used to validate our reflectance models that we were using. We didn't actually use it in the paper for doing the light stage captures, but I still have all the mini DV tapes, and we actually did do cross-polarized and parallel-polarized captures in Light Stage 1 with the idea that eventually we'd have a whole, you know, cross-polarized capture and spec-only capture as well through the difference imaging there. So that was kind of a somewhat over-ambitious project in some directions. And then the hope was that, you know, as soon as I got to USC and now was in the same town as Mark Sagar, that there'd be a chance to collaborate with him and push that further forward.
Okay.
And over the summer, Tim Hawkins and I, you know, once we got to USC in 2000, we worked on building Light Stage 2.
Yeah.
Time to have that open for the grand opening of the ICT, which was September 24th, 2000. So there's this mad 3-month rush to build Light Stage 2, which was a semicircle of strobe lights that went around. Kind of a more professional model than our single, you know, wooden gantry thing.
Right.
And, you know, after we were getting data, it was time to start working with Mark. And unfortunately, there was some political issue with the head of our institute at the time and the head of life effects at the time. And we weren't able to work with him for a couple of years. So it wasn't until Mark went to Sony ImageWorks.
Right.
And Scott Stockdyke had tuned into what we could do with the light stages and needed digital doubles for Spider-Man 2.
That's right.
That everything came together and we could finally map light stage data onto animated faces.
Right. And that was Doc Ock, right? That was
Doc Ock and then three shots of Tobey Maguire.
Okay. But I remembered a very specific Doc Ock shot that a lot of people don't realize or didn't realize that, you know, he was completely digital. I guess he was sinking in the water and he was really close up and unforgiving. It's not like a fast motion blur digital double. It was a face.
Yeah, it's a light stage data set mapped onto a basic cyberware 3D scan. It's only about a millimeter accurate, so it doesn't have any skin pore detail or anything. Right. But the images themselves, which are totally relightable, are, you know, scanned at high resolution off film recorders.
Right.
And the lighting artists had just as much control over lighting the digital character as they had of lighting all the CG elements. So like his trench coat was lit as a traditional CG element.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sony ImageWorks team, which included John Manos, wrote tools that let them move a point light. And when that point light hit the face, it would index in the real photograph of Alfred Molina lit from that direction.
Right.
And blend it into the facial texture.
Right.
And when it hit the cloth of his trench coat, it would do a traditional CG point light source rendering.
So it would serve two different purposes.
They got the two things to actually work together, which was a nice feat.
Yeah, that was really, really cool. And I remember it wasn't long after that I came to visit you and you guys had built your giant light stage.
Light Stage 6.
Light Stage 6,
right, which was built in late 2005.
Uh-huh.
And the story of Light Stage 6 is that actually, well, somehow we skipped a few light stages here, right? Light Stage 3, by the way, was the first one where we surrounded people with computer-controlled color LED illumination.
And we did, okay.
we brought a demo of that that had, it was also the first light stage that was a geodesic sphere.
And that was the one that you were able to light someone that was basically talking. So it was.
Yeah, it was basically lighting a person with an HDRI map, right. A light probe image.
Right.
And doing that in a way that they're just literally lit that way. The right colors and intensities of light are actually coming from all the different directions. Mm-hmm. And so you can just take pictures of them or shoot video of them and they're lit right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was some vague thought that, hey, this would be really useful for making movies because you can get the light right on your actors finally when you do a green screen shoot. Yep. And the first place that that was shown was at SIGGRAPH 2001, a year before the paper came out, as sort of the finale demo of the course that Dan Lem and I organized on image-based modeling, rendering, and lighting.
Okay.
And we got, I think she was a reporter from New Scientist magazine, Catherine Zandanella, as our test subject in the end. We only had 41 lights at the vertices of this 2-meter sphere. Mm-hmm. We were, I think we had to shoot the mat first mm-hmm. and then have people not move too far or else they'd move out of their own mat and, get ears chopped off and stuff. But it basically worked, and people seemed to think that was amusing at the conference. And then emboldened by that, tried to do an entire SIGGRAPH paper submission on it for 2002.
Right.
And that's when, I started shopping for black cloth that was infrared reflective. So right. I could do infrared compositing. And we had a beam splitter. I didn't want to put green screen behind people because we went to all this effort to get the lighting right on them. So we wanted them to be self-matting on black. So we did an IR beam splitter thing and got enough of the lights to put lights on all the edges. We were up to 156 light sources of these Color Kinetics iColor MR lights. And I also added a gantry to hold the actor so that we could spin the actor, keep the camera in the same place, and spin the lighting at the same time we spin the actor in sync mm-hmm. to give the impression of the camera moving around the actor, because we had to try to make these shots a little bit more interesting.
Right.
And once the actor's kind of, encaged in this thing that obscures a lot of the sight lines, if you want to have camera motion around the actor, you actually have to rotate the actor.
Right.
For this. And that was another thing that got implemented in the Gravity movie later, is that the actor would be on a gantry that could rotate. They could rotate the light in sync with the actor. And as a result, their camera didn't have to move left and right. It only had to move up and down and in and out. Yeah. And they could manage it with just kind of this vertical slit in the front of their LED panel system. And the most ambitious example that we did for light stage 3 was putting one of our actors into the Parthenon. So mm-hmm. we took our Parthenon model that we were using because we were already working on that movie.
Yep.
Lit it with a late afternoon HDRI map in Arnold, because mm-hmm. Marcos Fajardo, who wrote the amazing Arnold system, mm-hmm. Was a member of our lab back in the day. And we rendered a virtual light probe going down there, and we played that back on the light stage, and lo and behold, the actor kind of walked into sunlight and walked into shadow and picked up the colors of, colored banners that were on the wall next to her. And we got somebody to be composited into a CGI environment lit pretty accurately by that CGI environment completely automatically.
Right.
And that also seemed like something like, oh my God, at some point this has got to be useful for a movie. It saves so much time. And the story that I got back after giving the talk at SIGGRAPH 2002, mm-hmm. which seemed to go okay, is somebody told me that, I was sitting near John Knoll near the talk, and they even gestured to try to say that. And, John Knoll, amazing, one of the best visual effects supervisors of all time at this point.
Yeah.
Certainly, knows. He kind of just, threw up his hand and said, who needs it? Right. And I thought, okay, this is probably, maybe it's nice. It's like a good intellectual thought exercise, but maybe it's not, maybe cinematographers and VFX artists kind of know how to get the lighting right so that a good compositing artist can take it the rest of the way and you can get your movie made at this point.
Sure.
So it was an interesting. I think that thing was definitely a little bit ahead of its time because it didn't end up getting used commercially until The Social Network when they had to do the twins. The Winklevoss twins,
right.
And Light, the other twin, Armie Hammer. So we had Armie Hammer over at our Light stage to do tests for that.
Oh, okay, cool. Cool.
So that was Light Stage 3. I mentioned that just kind of leading up to Light Stage 6 because the reason that Light Stage 6 is 26 feet wide.
It's basically a really big Light Stage 3.
So it was supposed to be a really big Light Stage 3.
Right.
And the last two slides of the talk I gave at SIGGRAPH 2002 on Light Stage 3 were a proposal for Light Stage 4. I even wrote Light Stage 4 on them on the slides. And it was a big Light Stage 3. It was a big dome with color LEDs.
That allowed you to get like a, not just a
light
face,
the whole body.
Light the whole body, yep.
Multiple actors in there. I thought the camera should be on a big robot arm. It should be on a track so it can move in and out, so mm-hmm. it can rotate around. I thought we might need a special light source to be the sun because expecting every single light in your entire light stage to be able to go to the full intensity of the sun might be too many LEDs to do. So maybe we'll have like on a separate gantry some really bright white LED source or even a traditional HMI that can move around and be the sun. So
right.
That one has to be mechanically operated, but the rest of it could be done. There. And that's what Light Stage 4 was supposed to be.
Sure.
And I had this little white paper out and I proposed to the Institute, hey, you know, it'd be great to build, you know, Light Stage 4. Let's go big with this thing. And that sort of went nowhere from 2001 to 2003 to 2004. But in 2004, something very interesting happened, which is bright white LEDs became available.
Uh-huh.
And LEDs are nice because they can turn on real fast and turn off real fast. They're basically transistors, and the light just shows up when you start putting current in, and it disappears when you stop putting current.
Right.
You can turn them, you know, you can turn different LEDs on at hundreds of thousands of times per second.
Right.
So the idea then was, well, you know what? If we got a high-speed camera, and if we upgraded the lights of Light Stage 3 so they were really bright white LEDs, we could shoot a traditional one light at a time light stage data set.
Right.
Really fast, like in a 24th of a second.
Uh-huh.
And you could basically light stage your actor every 24th of a second over and over and over.
Yep.
And record them in a way that you can light them after the fact in post-production with any lighting environment that you want.
Yeah, basically you're going back to light stage one.
It's light stage one, really fast.
Really fast, exactly.
And we got a whole bunch of LumaLEDs, Luxeon 5 LEDs.
Yep.
Andy Gardner helped glue them on to a bunch of boards.
Yeah.
We got a new control system running that could send electronic system signals to them really fast, say which lights should be on.
Uh-huh.
And that was our SIGGRAPH 2005 paper.
Right.
That was about post-production relighting. So we can have an actor perform. The lights are moving so fast, they're just kind of in a big ball of light. They don't know that they're being lit from different directions. And then you record for, you know, 10 seconds on your high-speed camera and you
right.
get all this data, but then you can light them in whatever lighting environment you want after the fact.
But I think, and I don't know if you did it for this particular light stage or this was an evolution of it, but one thing that I thought was really interesting is you didn't actually light each individual light at a time. You actually lit patterns of light, and
we were able to
subtract the patterns to derive each light.
We tried different things on this, and one of them was actually just single lights. And you know, we were shooting with really fast lenses, and we had an enormously sensitive camera with like 22 micron pixels
mm-hmm.
that are, you know, like a cell phone camera has like 1.2 micron pixels. These
right.
are 22 by 22, so they're really, you know, hundreds of times more sensitive than a cell phone camera. That was good. And we did one light at a time. That was actually we still didn't get a good exposure on the camera. It was a little dim, but we did show examples of that. A lot of our results in the paper are where we do clusters of three lights at a time. So we light a small triangle of lights, mm-hmm. and that gave us enough light. But we also wanted to experiment with this idea that had been proposed by Yoav Shechner et al. Of using Hadamard patterns, which he'd done with like a video projector on a wall, trying to do some image-based relighting stuff of objects. And so in this case, if you have a certain number of light sources, basically half the lights plus one are on at any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you still do the same number of patterns. So if you're going to try to have 156 lighting conditions, you still do 156 patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But since light is additive, you can actually light linear combinations of light and then do a matrix solve to get back to what the individual lighting directions would be.
Right.
And so we ran these Hadamard patterns. The whole light stage then was much brighter, which was good. We could mm-hmm. use a smaller aperture. And get some depth of field back. And it worked, and we were able to do the relighting. The thing that happened, though, is that if you asked from this data, where basically the whole face is lit from everywhere every time, but just kind of with different, checkerboards of, randomized checkerboards of patterns.
Sure.
Is that the reconstructed lighting conditions would look good where the face was lit, but when the face was in shadow, it would be noisy. Because the way that cameras work is that, you get your signal plus you get some noise, and the noise you get is has some dependence on the signal itself. There's a little bit of just additive noise that you're going to get regardless mm-hmm. of whether light's hitting the sensor or not.
Right.
But then there's also something called photon noise, which is proportional to the square root of the number of photons that hit you.
Okay.
And so if you've got a pixel value that's four times brighter than another pixel value, it's actually going to have twice the noise. It's going to have twice the photon noise. And what happened is that since the face was lit pretty much everywhere all the time in every one of the conditions, you'd be getting those higher amounts of noise everywhere on the face. It doesn't look bad because since the signal's got so much higher, you actually have a better signal to noise ratio.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you run it through the matrix and it adds and subtracts a bunch of images from each other to then compute, the whole side of the face in shadow,
mm-hmm.
the noise that's on top of the shadow is like the noise from the bright images.
Okay.
So it's a little bit like, you live, you don't smoke and you live in a house with a smoker and you end up with lung cancer from secondhand smoke. It's like our pixels had secondhand noise from all those bright pixels,
right.
And then it got computed down. So, we did it for the paper. I think it's a really cool technique, great idea, but it didn't seem practical for those reasons. So we didn't ultimately use that.
Okay.
Now the thing is with that light stage, once we'd added all of those white LEDs, I kind of wanted to call it light stage 3.1 because we stuck them on light stage 3.
Right.
We actually didn't even put them exactly where they're supposed to go because it was important to me. Hey, I don't want to take off the color LEDs. I kind of like those. Let's put the white LEDs on there. So they're next to the color LEDs. And so I thought light stage 3.1. But then I realized, we've actually put more effort into this project than we did building light stage 3 because these are custom lights, custom electronics. Light stage 3 was off the shelf stuff.
Right.
And I think in honor of the team, I thought, this should be a full light stage. This is not a 0.1.
Yeah.
It's not light stage 4 because I had that slide at SIGGRAPH 2002 that showed what light stage 4 is. It was supposed to be a big light stage 3, and that never happened. So, okay, this is light stage 5. That's what we called it.
Okay.
And light stage 5 ended up transmogrifying itself into our high-res facial scanning process.
Right.
Because at some point, I started thinking, hey, if we put polarizers on every single light, could we cross-polarize out the specular reflection of the whole sphere? And then could we then flip the polarizer on the camera quickly, get the specular back in, and do a polarization difference image that's just the specular reflection of the face? Yep. And that ended up leading to the high-res facial scanning process that got all of the detail from the specular component that we ended up using on the Digital Emily project and the avatar scans and the Digital Ira project and all of that.
Yeah. So basically, obviously one of the you were looking at basic relighting faces and then lighting faces live on stage and then building it up to a different size. And then you started to turn it into a high speed light stage one, and then suddenly it started to become a scanner.
Yep.
And that's the thing that really is now it's most known for as being a scanner at this point.
It took a long while.
And a scanner is belittling what it is because it's way more, it's a very, very fancy scanner.
I mean, I think it's still the currently the highest resolution resolution way to record a face.
Right.
And that's because we use a combination of geometric and photometric information to get all of that surface detail. There's a, you know, you can do passive photogrammetry on faces, kind of just diffusely light your subject, take pictures from a lot of things, throw it into some photogrammetry solve, and then, you know, kind of like emboss a high pass filter of the diffuse, and it kind of looks like there's skin pores and stuff. That,
right.
That structure, Graham Fife actually just did a comparison of that.
I love his t-shirt, by the way. Did you see his t-shirt?
Oh, yes, yes. Let's see here.
Your high-risk scan
is my base mesh. That was awesome. That was totally awesome. You know, I mean, the diffuse embossed, it's wrong. I mean, it looks attractive, but once you actually use that as your displacement map and you light it with a photoreal renderer and you light the skin, it looks like the person's had some kind of terrible skin disease, particularly like the nose, because the nose is actually very smooth and specular.
Yeah.
But people have, you know, skin pores on the nose, and there's usually stuff in the skin pores, or at least they get a little bit redder. And so those tend to cause little dimples in the nose, and the tip of your nose looks like a golf ball with the diffuse emboss.
Right.
If you analyze the specular component, then it's nice and smooth, and then you
you
get that. So that's really, you know, I think the most industrially useful process right now. And when we scan faces for the industry, that's the first thing that people order is they want a bunch of facial scans in different facial expressions.
Sure.
We have the Vuvuzela process that'll put them all into the same UV space. So you've got, you know, pretty straightforward blend shaping from there.
Yep.
And then the high-end folks will ask for, and this is, you know, Weta, Digital Domain, ILM, they'll ask for one light at a time data sets back to the old SIGGRAPH 2000 process.
Yes.
As a, you know, lighting validation, you really know how the face looks lit from every direction light can come from. We can also shoot that with separated diffuse and specular. So you can look at what just the spec looks like from every direction, what just the diffuse looks like from every direction. And then you can do image-based relighting on it. And, you know, DD has these Nuke plugins that they can just drop an HDRI map on your face from that and then validate what it looks like in all the environments.
Yeah. The way that I remembered, or when I was working there, is that basically you have your all that data set where it's lit from one at a time. It all goes into a bundle. They have a special Nuke node that basically knows which light corresponds to which, analyzes the HDR, samples each HDR, and then does basically what you were doing in light stage one on the fly right in Nuke. And the best advantage of that is that you're basically looking at a photograph that's correctly lit, and you can do it in an environment that is done. And then if you have the same HDR, you can put your CG character in there and say, my CG character needs to look like that. So it's almost exact reference under any lighting condition, which is the key to that, right?
Well, I think it's useful because when you're staring at a rendering and you're trying to figure out, is this right? Does it look real? You know, it's not a fun situation to be in when something is like kind of working but kind of not, and you just don't know what the problem is.
Right.
And if you can actually say, okay, wait, this is what the real person looked like from that angle in that lighting, then you can now look at this, look at that, say, oh, here's the difference. That's great. Or you can flip between them.
And there's also a useful, especially when you're doing look development, is not to look at the person in the exact same lighting condition and do all your look development in one single lighting condition. So by having that reference, like, you know what, we should look at them in an overcast condition. We should look at them in a bright sunlight condition. And all of those things matter. And you have that advantage to be able to basically create an infinite amount of reference of this person. And then also do the lighting in the same exact thing. So it's really cool.
And that's one of the things that we're doing, you know, just even in a basic way with this MLE 2.0 work that we're doing through the Digital Human League. Is that we're making sure that the face looks like the reference, A, in point line conditions, and B, in you know, diffuse sphere conditions as well. And anything that's going to match in both of those has a good chance of matching everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. So that you brought her up. Let's sort of jump into it. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff that we can go into what facial scanning is and all the amazing projects that have been done on it, because the amount of people that have been gone, they've walked through ICT and gotten scanned is amazing. I've been to a couple of those myself, but there's a lot of people that have been scanned and really amazing data that you guys have collected over time. And you've obviously got a lot of experience on it, but you guys are also, you guys are a research institute. So you're constantly refining and trying new things and doing, you know, have new ideas about it. I don't think you'll ever rest until you've come up with another idea. So I think that's an important part of what the life stage is. It's not just someone is like, oh, we'll just go to life stage and do it and it'll be the same process. You're always trying new things, right? So as an example, wasn't too long ago that you guys came up with the new way of doing sub-pore level displacement map, right? Which is something that we had been, I've been always interested in actually looking at what that was like. Mm-hmm. So can you tell a little bit about how you get that? Because obviously you said you do, the normal scan is basically you get your model and you get a displacement map to get some pretty high level displacement on there, but you could go even further now.
Yeah, so a light stage scan right now is like 10th of a millimeter accurate. And that's enough to see skin pores, fine creases, you know, all of the expressive wrinkles that show up in different facial expressions.
A 10th of a millimeter, yeah.
But it kind of dawned on me, or it was pretty clear that there's more going on here. And I thought, it would be very interesting. What if we could light stage at much higher resolution, just a little patch of skin and see what's going on? And working with our grad student, Paul Graham, we actually built a miniature light stage that was only like 18 inches across, a teeny one, out of extra lights that we had from one of our other light stage projects.
Right.
And so we put the polarizers on there. We put first a Canon camera with a 100 macro lens on it. And that lens will do 1:1 macro, which means that, you know, 1 millimeter of what you're taking a picture of ends up focusing onto 1 millimeter of the sensor.
Right.
Now, it turns out that, you know, the Canon camera has about 5 micron pixels.
Right.
Which is a 200th of a millimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you move this camera close to the face, focus it on it so it's in 1:1 macro, you will see better than 100th of a millimeter detail for the skin. So we did our same polarized gradient illumination patterns to isolate the specular reflection. At that scale, subsurface would definitely, you know, kill any semblance of detail that you could see in the diffuse components. So we have to focus on the specular, which has no subsurface. So we can do our kind of spherical photometric stereo kind of thing.
And we're talking about an area about an inch square, right?
Yeah, something like that. Well, I mean, if we're 1:1, then we have like 36 by 24 millimeters on the camera sensor. In practice, we end up just focusing on 1 centimeter of that because we push the face onto a little metal aperture that we had cut.
So you have a little flat area.
So that you can kind of flatten the skin. And most importantly, so you can hold the face at a constant distance from the camera. Because with macro photography, you have very, very little depth of field.
Right. And very sensitive to any kind of motion.
Absolutely.
Right.
So the whole thing has to have like a rigid connection between the aperture to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
So we built this and we started photographing some of the samples. And we were getting some good results, and we're seeing really interesting textures of skin at this scale that definitely don't get picked up in a regular light stage scan. Eventually, we realized that, you know what, we don't even need the little light stage. What we could do is we could just use the big light stage, run it a little brighter, and put the metal aperture to hold the skin and the camera that records it inside the light stage, and we could do the microgeometry capture right in there. You know, it's a bit of an ordeal, but we've done this commercially too. People have ordered this. And so it's been like me and a relatively famous person in the light stage with me helping them press their face
getting
up against this little metal plate, over and over. And again, you know, we're very happy that we've had, you know, cooperative, interested subjects that have put up with this at this point. Anyway, the idea is that, like, we don't have time to go and, like, stick every square centimeter of your face up to this thing. That's not going to happen. So what we'll do is we'll do a form of constrained texture synthesis, where we'll use texture synthesis techniques to up-res the light stage scan.
So you take your base displacement, you know where the scan was, and then you say, based on what I know from the overall scan, I can clone or match that pattern.
Exactly. We synthesize the high frequencies of the texture that are missing in the you know, the medium scale scan. We call what the standard light stage gets at 10th of a millimeter, we call that mesoscale detail, and then we call this microscale detail.
Right. And so you scan what you figured out, you know, obviously you guys know faces pretty well, you know, there's probably several patterns that you would get in a face. So you'll measure like your forehead and your cheek.
Yeah, we do the forehead, the temple, the nose, the cheek, and the chin.
Okay.
And they're all different.
You know,
every there's more variation within one person's face than there is of the same part of the face across individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, different parts of the face have different functions and they have different motions. The texture of the skin is actually correlated and tied to the way that that skin moves. Because what happens is that if you're on a part of the face that tends to compress and expand vertically a lot, then you'll have, on the micro scale, tiny little horizontal furrows in there. It's basically like a tiny little accordion that can stretch out and compress. And since that first layer of your skin, the stratum corneum, you know, that's designed to be some tough, stiff stuff because it's got to keep all the germs out and keep you from getting cut and stuff like that. So it's actually pretty amazing.
We're not amphibians anymore. We need to have some skin that
holds
up.
And if it didn't have all of this little kind of surface wrinklage here, it wouldn't be able to stretch and compress. It needs to kind of look like an accordion. And so some parts of the skin have like three different directions that gives it this kind of like Voronoi diagram looking stuff with all these little triangles. And some of it's just kind of flat and some of it's very anisotropic in different ways. And I think it would be kind of fun. You could actually almost, if you got a super, super high resolution scan of somebody's face only in neutral, you could actually figure out just by the directions of the skin textures what their facial expressions would look like, because the skin actually ends up encoding how much stretch and compression.
It's like the wrinkles that are left over. Yeah, that's interesting. What I thought was always interesting to me is when Graham and I were talking about this, Graham and I have been long, old-time friends, and he was telling me about this technique, and I said, why do you need a 16K displacement map? What's the importance of that? And what he made very clear to me, because Graham is also very good at explaining things in a very simple way, he said that if you think about it, a lot of people obsess about trying to create very complex BRDFs to get roughness in skin that is not visible from certain areas. So that roughness, you know, they'll say, oh, you need a Cook-Torrance shader to do that, or you need a GGX shader to do that, or you need something like that in order to mimic micro stuff that's going on any given surface. But now you have it for real. And specular is about the breakup of light.
Yeah, the way we used to think about specular on faces is that, okay, well, the nose is the shiniest, the cheeks are dull, the forehead is kind of somewhere in between, and we got to set different specular roughness values everywhere. In fact, skin is kind of made out of the same substance. It has the same index of refraction everywhere, so you're basically going to get the same spec everywhere. It's just that the surface shape is different everywhere at this micro scale. So if you can actually put it into your models, then you naturally get the different variations that you would have on the surface of the skin. And it certainly changed how we think about faces by doing this work in the right way to model them. I'd say the work was also, you know, inspired in part by conversations we had with Weta Digital and Joe Letteri. He was the first person, when he looked at our scans that we did of Zoe Saldana and Sam Worthington and such for Avatar, which we were delivering in 4K maps,
Yeah.
Nowadays, I think we deliver 6K, even just for a standard light stage scan. But he wanted 8K at the time, which just sounded crazy. It's like 8K. Wow. Okay. Well, we'll try to think about that one. But he was onto something too. I mean, partly it's that, you know, the Na'vi, you know, are actually physically larger than people. So sure. Maybe they need more pixels on their texture maps.
Right.
You know, what I'm really excited about this year at SIGGRAPH is we're going to be presenting a paper. The lead author is Koki Nagano, one of mm-hmm. our graduate students in the lab, about a nice, or at least a straightforward technique to simulate how skin microgeometry will change as a face goes to different expressions.
Right.
And, you know, part of this, I was interested in trying to come up with a solution to the problem. And, you know, honestly, we tried a whole bunch of stuff, and it's been great to have, you know, Graham and Koki and Oleg Alexander around to try to think through and prototype different approaches. What we're actually publishing is at least the fourth version of some good approximation to this.
Because,
uh-huh. you know, doing a finite element simulation of, you know, the surface of the skin at 16K by 16K resolution
mm-hmm.
Is pretty scary. I mean, that's, yeah. you know, a quarter billion pixels. And then if you have any voxel density down below, I mean, you're just, you can't simulate that.
Right.
The technique that Koki has put together just blurs and sharpens the displacement maps.
On the fly
right. in the direction of the stretch. So basically, if you stretch a forehead vertically, so you'll stretch the forehead if you pull your eyebrows down,
mm-hmm.
Then it will actually blur the displacement map in the vertical direction.
Which basically reduces the micro...
Which reduces the microgeometry, which makes it look like those little accordions of microgeometry have stretched out and flattened.
Yep.
And if you raise your eyebrows, then it'll add additional microstructure. And of course, this is way beyond, you know, the resolution of forehead furrows, which hopefully came from the light stage scans of that expression.
Right.
But it'll make the shape of the microgeometry and the specular that you get. And, you know, I was seeing these effects for a couple of years. You know, if I was just standing in front of a bathroom mirror mm-hmm. with, you know, a light above the mirror, I could see the specular reflection of my forehead. I'd raise my eyebrows and lower my eyebrows, and I'd see radically different specular response of my forehead.
Yeah, I remember seeing a picture that they did as reference. It was just, I think it was Ari, and it was just a tight picture of his cheek and a single flash, and it looked, you know, like you'd expect skin. You see all the pores and stuff, and then he just, you know, puffed his cheek out, and it was smooth.
it's a totally, you know, crazy, incredibly evident thing that happens on faces that, you know, even after 40 years at looking at faces, you know, both professionally and for personal reasons,
right,
had never really become conscious of.
Right.
And, you know, then you can almost not unsee it at some point. This just reinforces, I started telling myself this, you know, 15 years ago, which is that if you ever look at a face and you think you see everything that's going on, or that you're conscious of everything that's going on, you're probably wrong.
Yeah.
And there's more to this. So that was just kind of the philosophy, is like, okay, there's probably something, but we weren't even sure that there was something interesting. So now it turns out that there's something interesting. I thought easily this whole area was like, okay, we're totally dealing with unnecessary higher order bits that are in noise about what's going on with faces. And I didn't get any validation that this was actually, you know, useful in practice until, you know, our good friends at Activision, Javier van der Palen's research group, put skin microgeometry onto digital Ira, because they're, you know, genius skin shader guys, looked at our skin samples that we were capturing and came up with some procedural shaders that you can just add on to the low res detail, which they were actually taking our 4K maps of Ira and taking them down to 2K so that they would plausibly run in a real time game engine, like a PS4 or Xbox One for multiple characters. And it can't be the only thing it's rendering.
Mm-hmm.
And they put that detail on there, and all of a sudden it got so much better. Steve Rosenbaum, who's one of the VFX soups for Avatar, and he souped the digital Michael Jackson character at the Billboard Music Awards last year, found that the microgeometry work that they did on that, which we were in touch with them about, really helped the digital Michael Jackson look that much more realistic.
Right.
Even though, you know, he's never seen close up. You know, that's a full body image of him that's up on a stage, but they were having trouble really getting the skin to look like skin
until
they started modeling in what's going on with microgeometry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very important to see that. And I definitely see the difference. And especially, you know, with what Cookie's doing, it's something that, you know, if you're going to do like a more complex BRDF and you don't necessarily have that data, because of the fact that it's changing, you know, like it goes from smooth to sharper or based on expression, you're not going to be able to mimic that with as easily if you're doing just a uniform noise across or uniform BRDF across everything that basically just adds all that stuff in.
Yep.
So I think it's really kind of interesting to think about what that is and how that works. But I was always fascinated with it. I approached you about, and we can talk, we're kind of actually already at an hour, but I'll just go quickly about some of the stuff we've done on WikiHuman. But I approached you about working on WikiHuman, and you guys just were totally excited about it. I was very, very happy that you know, you guys said, oh yeah, let's work on this stuff. We got stuff we want to try and test and do things. And I got a great group of people that were really interested in participating and a great group of artists as well. And it really was inspiring that I don't think I ever would have been as successful as it's been so far if you guys weren't just as excited about it as I am.
Well, we're very excited about it. And I think one of the things that I knew the collaboration would probably entail is also producing some stuff that doesn't look right.
Yeah.
And then have to figure out how to get
that
hump.
That's
learning something in the process.
We have to fail in order to get better, right? And that's okay. And that's we've done some of those exercises. And I don't necessarily want to say that, you know, our first foray, well, we're learning it right now as an example. And we'll put it out there because we're putting out the first set of digital data from the Emily stuff that I presented at FMX. And it was a really good first step into what we're doing, and it really showcased what we are. But what's great about it is that once we created that, you guys just started using it really hardcore and doing different things with it. And because you were doing it in the lab scenario, because you guys are a lab, you started finding issues. It's like, oh, you know what? We need to do this. We need to do that. We need to do this. So that's constantly going to evolve in that process. And, you know, we'll follow up with that. It's like, okay, now that we know all this, we'll release new data.
It's probably ultimately going to change how we capture faces in the light stage.
Really?
Because now that we've gotten rid of the video projectors, because, you know, Graham's solve process doesn't really need any of the noise patterns or structured light most of the time at this point. So that saved us a few lighting conditions. And so now we have a few more that we can think of extending the budget. And and then there's some things that we've actually been exploring with our Activision friends that actually make the light stage capture process radically faster,
right?
Which is pretty exciting. Hopefully we'll get to talk about those things in the near future. But suppose we really want to try to more directly capture stuff that you can really turn into the parameters for a subsurface shader that are a complex subsurface scatter. Everyone knows that, you know, just the simple sigma A, sigma S, you know, of the single layer, it's not enough for skin.
No, it's not enough. It's gotten us pretty far, but it's not enough. And, you know, we always want to know what more you can do. And I had lunch with Steve Prieg not too long ago, also a member of the league, and we were discussing it. And he was interested in saying, we should look at some more MRI data. We've got to find out what the thickness of skin actually is in different areas and what's underneath that skin, like what's in there somehow. Because the joke I made...
I think he wants to dissect somebody.
I think he does want to dissect somebody. He is pretty morbid. But the thing that I said at FMX is that, you know, if you look at some skin shaders, they'll have, you know, here's your deep scatter, your medium scatter, and your shallow scatter. But we can't really know what a deep scatter. I can't peel someone's skin back and find out what's inside of it.
Well, we did something, you know, when Abhijit Ghosh was a member of our lab. So the Ghosh et al. 2008 paper,
right,
was a multi-layer subsurface scattering acquisition technique.
Okay.
And there we used a video projector. And what we did is we phase shifted some lines of a video projector and we looked between the lines to see subsurface and we looked on top of the lines to see the direct component there.
Right.
And so this is using like the Sri Nair direct indirect separation inspired technique, but we used it for trying to figure out subsurface parameters.
So the best technique generally that we have now to look at subsurface on skin is the shadow, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the area where if you have a projector and you have a line and you have a dark area and a white area,
yeah.
The what the skin does at that line, because the skin will scatter, will glow slightly in the black area of that yeah. light. And that's how you figure out what that subsurface is supposed to do, right?
Yeah. And I mean, another pattern that we've done in some other work is we call it the Swiss cheese pattern. So yeah. you video project a white frame with a lot of black dots in it. And the dots are maybe 3/8 of an inch in diameter when they hit the face.
Okay.
And then you just watch the light bleed into the dots. And if you shoot a, you know, full on image that doesn't have the black dots and one that does have the black dots, you can look at two images, one which is the difference of the two, which makes it look like they've got white dots on their face, mm-hmm. and the other of which is just the black dot image. And or you can shoot at white dots and then black dots. But anyway, you look at the difference between those two. That will tell you where the accurate edge of the dot should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Because one has it scattering out, the other one has it scattering in, so it's presumably symmetrical.
Right.
So you can figure out where the dots actually would have been if the face didn't scatter stuff. And then you could look and quantify, graph out what the scattering curve looks like in there.
Oh, okay.
And that's something that we've done to, you know, in the research papers.
Uh-huh.
It's not something, we've shot that data and given it to people as reference,
mm-hmm.
But it hasn't yet made it into like an actual commercial delivery out of late stage data
yet. Right, right.
And that's something that I think will, I think that this collaboration, it's making the, hey, we need to bring that back or we need to improve it and we need to make it a real first class part of the late stage
right.
process.
Right, right, right.
And the idea, you know, what you pitched to me was just really a great thing, which is like, okay, we've got great acquisition systems, we've got great rendering systems. How do we plug A into B in a way that doesn't involve, you know, yet another R&D project mm-hmm. for some studio to figure this out?
Because the problem is a lot of studios are figuring this stuff out and they all think they have their solutions. And those and they are very valid solutions, but there is a lot of, you know, I mean, there's a lot of you guys scan the data. He's like, here's some data for you. And people go, all right, thank you very much. And they don't talk to you and they just do whatever they want to do to the data. There should be a way. It's like, here is a methodology that you guys can use to reconstruct this method.
Well, one of the biggest reasons that, you know, we see a lot of value by working with industry is that we get to hear back from people about how the stuff we're doing in our research has actually been useful or mm-hmm. relevant and what are the gaps that they had to fill in order to actually make use of it. And getting into conversations with people like Steve Prieg from Digital Domain or Dan Lemon or Joe Letteri from Weta Digital,
right.
You know, who are, you know, some of the best in the biz and great at talking about what they do and really interested in, you know, not trying to be super secret proprietary about everything, but trying to actually have like a discourse that will, move the field forward in a significant yeah. way, is that we get to learn a lot of these things, but hopefully it'll get to the point where we synthesize between, you know, what's happened on the artistic side, what's happened on the technological side in a way that it just becomes a tool that's reliable. And it makes this thing that seems like a very complicated thing to do, which is like to get a photoreal digital character, you know, rigged and rendered.
Right.
Which, you know, scanning it, we know how to do that. But getting a fully rigged, renderable digital character, you know, with teeth, with hair, with eyes, mm-hmm. with lips that touch each other and say B and P appropriately, mm-hmm. There's no, you know, just like, hey, we know how to do that. And it's a simple way.
Right.
Different people know pieces of the puzzle because there have been photoreal digital characters yeah. in films, but it's still, you know, a certain amount of rumor and lore and magic. And we want to make this something that can get to the point where, going back to how we started this conversation, can be explained in very simple terms because we finally all understand it in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. And the thing that inspired me to do it, to be honest, is conversations with you and Graham more specifically, because I got into a lot more detail with him about, he's explaining how simple it really should be or could be. And I said, well, let's just make the really simple version. Because every time I look at a shader that was done, it's always gotten way out of control, complicated. And which is fine, and it works and it looks great. I mean, there's no question the pixies on Maleficent are amazing. There was an incredibly complex shader. I don't know if it needed to be as complex as it did. Probably did, because there was a lot of other things that were going into it.
Maybe it did. But like the first explanations of, you know, how Mars moves around in the sky,
right?
Which didn't realize that the Earth and Mars are both going around the sun, and they tried to figure out a way in which like Mars is going around the Earth.
Right.
Like, made no freaking sense. And they right. had all these weird ecliptic stuff, crazy equations to do right. it. And then finally, at some point, people said, hey, you know, if Mars is going around the sun, Earth is going around the sun, then now the fact that it goes retrograde every so often, okay, that totally makes sense, because they're just basically going two things in ellipses.
Two things in ellipses.
So we need to figure out like the two ellipse explanation of the photoreal face,
right?
Not the complex differential equations version
exactly.
of the photoreal face.
Yeah. And so I asked Graham, it's like, break down the shader to me based on the way you think it needs to be. And that's where we started with in what I'm presenting at FMX. And it was a really simple model. You know, it was like, you know, it needs to have this type of subsurface. It needs to have this type. This is what the single scatter should be, how that should be used. And it needs to be a two-lobe specular and how that binds together. And it was very simple. It's gotten more complex since then. And there's other things we've done. But I want to say, let's start with that. And the advantage that I thought, especially because you guys like were willing to share the scan data, right, in some shape or form, is we can now I just imagine some guy, you know, some student in Sweden. I'm using this as an example because that's pretty much someone who came up to me at FMX and just was like so thankful about it, because she said, I'm modeling and doing character work, and what you're now providing me with is a base of, here's what my diffuse should look like, here's what my specular should look like, and here's how I assemble it. She's not going to use the data directly. She's going to use the data as reference for what she's doing herself. And she'll know that what she's done has some validity as opposed to her just guessing at this point. So I really love that. He's like, this is good reference for you.
That would be great.
Yeah. So that's my my goal. And I've been happy about it. Obviously, we want to go a lot further with the WikiHuman project. There's a lot of great stuff. You guys are already coming up with some crazy ideas if you want to do. And you're using the data, which is wonderful. So that's been a lot of fun. What are one of the things you most look forward to in terms of this project that you think would be really fun to do?
Well, I think it would be fun to actually, I don't know, make a short film using digital characters.
Well, right? Yeah.
It used to be when, you know, I did a research paper and came up with a new technique that, you know, I could finish the SIGGRAPH paper and then spend the next couple months after that making a movie with it.
Like the Parthenon project.
Like the Parthenon, like the Campanile came right after the facade modeling and rendering
architecture. The Fiat Lux project.
Fiat Lux came out right after image-based lighting and then hybridizing it with the image-based modeling and rendering. And, you know, I've never gotten to make a movie with any digital humans in it. The only way to do that is to, you know, develop technology, then, you know, partner with Image Metrics or Activision or Weta or Digital Domain, because the rest of it isn't like, you know, wrapped up in a bow, ready to use.
Sure.
It's like, you know, we need to do real heavy lifting work to take this and put it on the screen or into the video game. And so, you know, the chances for proving that this is valid for independent filmmaking or smaller scale efforts, which is where I think it would be really valuable. It's like the independent filmmakers don't have the kind of budgets that let them cast any kind of face in any kind of environment doing any sure. kind of thing.
But there's some really talented artists out there, individuals that are doing some amazing work, obviously.
So, yeah. So I think we need to show that you can do something that's got photoreal digital characters that's not in a $200 million movie.
Right.
You know, maybe not a $200 movie.
Right, right.
But, you know, there's a lot more stories to be told, and most stories are about people. So
yeah.
let's make it possible to visually tell stories about people without having to go through all the expense of traditional filmmaking.
Yeah, I think that's a very good one. That's, and you know, sort of bringing the power to probably the most challenging thing in character work right now, especially digital humans, bringing that power back to an individual so that it's not just a scary thing, right? And the reason things are always scary is because people are always fearful of that uncanny valley situation, which I've mentioned
before. Oh, and it's a real thing.
It's a real thing. You can put,
if you accidentally release some early version of some rendering, it can scare people.
And it'll scare people for a long time. And that's the problem. It scares people for so long that I'm not going to sugarcoat. When we were working on Maleficent, there are some points where the character was not looking right. And because of that fear of what was wrong with it, it took way longer to get to the other point because you were still, it was like, you know, post-traumatic stress of like, mm-hmm. oh no, this is, oh. And then it's once you just calm down and you like just worked on it a little bit, oh, it was so much better. But mm-hmm. it is an emotional problem. And that's part of the thing that fascinates me is why does that happen as well? So I'm not necessarily trying to be as strong as getting something out of the uncanny valley. I would love to do that, obviously. That would be a great goal. But my goal is not to get out of the uncanny valley. Is also to see why do we react the way that we do with an uncanny valley and test it, you know, as those failures are going to let us learn a little bit about ourselves a bit as well. And I think that's something that both Mike Seymour and Angela are interested in is what makes something uncanny and why does it look uncanny and testing that emotionally. And
that's something that could be done in a much more scientific way once there is a wiki human, because right now I've seen a couple of studies that, you know, students and Angela and they've tried to do it, and they're using the best data available,
right.
But to some extent it's comparing apples to oranges. Cause you know, you have, let's see if digital Emily is as real as digital Ira, as Benjamin Button, as the kid in Polar Express.
Right.
But, you know, they're all in different lighting. They're different styles. They were created for different reasons. They're from different angles. They're not the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really not actually producing, you know, a direct measurement of like a particular variable that you're testing.
Right.
And it's the best that can be done at the moment. But since the samples are so small,
right,
it's hard to average out over all of those systematic errors that you might get. So I think it would be great if we had, you know, there's another study, like Rachel McDonald's done a project called Render Me Real.
Mm-hmm.
And she created a digital character. She published it at SIGGRAPH. She's in Ireland. And they did the best, highest quality digital character they could do at the time of a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did stylized renderings and line drawing renderings and with subsurface, without subsurface. And they tried to test people's reaction to all of these. But the problem is they still didn't have a totally real version
mm-hmm.
of it. And they couldn't start with totally real and then move away from that in all the different directions.
Right.
That's where it would get really interesting. Like, do you need the blinks to be right on? Do you need lipstick, sticky lips to be
right, sticky lips,
on?
Yeah. I'm interested in blood flow as well, obviously.
Do you need blood flow or not? Right, turn that on and off. Turn forehead wrinkles on and off. Turn microgeometry on and off.
Yep.
Let's figure out which of these things are...
actually matter, and how much detail do you put in the eyes? Do you need the tear ducts? Do you need all of these different things that are happening?
At the same time, let me say one other thing, because I do, you know, like any researcher, you know, who needs funding to keep moving, you know, you're always having to justify your research program.
Sure.
And there's always other people in whatever organization that you're in or whatever funding structure that you're in that, you know, have other ideas of things that could be potentially, you know, other things they could be spending the money on. So why are we investing in this? And sometimes they're said, well, you know, we don't really need the high fidelity face. We can just do with the low fidelity face. It's like, and sometimes folks will say, like, those characters in those Pixar movies, you know, they're not photoreal humans. People like that. Those are great, you know, great films. They make a lot of money. And I have to explain, it's like, you realize that a Pixar movie is not easy to make.
Right.
Like, they cost about $75,000 a second
right.
to make a Pixar film.
Right.
And there's like a 4-year process of designing the characters, and they have some of the highest paid people of below the line expenses in the entire movie industry who are the animators for those Pixar characters yep. because they literally bring things to life, you know, through sheer force of will, creating those animation curves and stuff. It's like one of the highest forms of art in existence right now to make those Pixar movies. And that's why we relate to the characters. It's great character design, great stories, and great animation. And none of that's fully automatic.
Right.
You know, they're not using mocap to do that because they couldn't get that kind of result.
Right.
Well, for photoreal human characters, you know, we can actually record what real people look like. We can study how real light interacts with real skin. And all of these things can be simulated through data and physics and the kinds of things that computers
we're designed
should
to do.
Be good at and are designed to do and ultimately are going to be super fast.
Right.
There were complaints about trying to do photoreal humans because, hey, you know, this stuff needs to run on mobile devices. And what do you, you know, think? Well, guess what? You can run digital Ira on a tablet.
Right.
No problem. And in fact, you'll run it on a cell phone no problem soon enough. You know, it's just a couple of Moore's laws there. But I think that photoreal characters are really, since they're the things that obey physics and can be observed in the real world, they're the only things that you could ever just do as a mostly automated process or a fully automated process. Because, you know, the artistry that goes into a Pixar character is fundamentally not an automatic process. So this is going to be the cheapest way to do it.
And I think there's actually, that's part of the challenge of creating a digital character or digital human right now is that some people don't necessarily understand that, right? They're sculpting and they're doing a lot of things and they're messing around with that physics, those physics, and not realizing that they are. Mm-hmm. And that's why they stray from the reality and from the physics. And therefore, that's when things start to not look quite right and they don't know exactly know why. It's like, that's because you took the diffuse map that you got scanned and calibrated and just made it redder.
But it's great. And that's what I love about the league is it has some, it has Dan Rorty.
Dan Rorty, yeah. He's going to be here in a week
or
two.
And has Luc Bégin as well, who I just saw in Montreal. I mean, these guys blow me away with their work and their process. And they're wonderful to have as part of the conversation. I would have loved to have, you know, been able to talk to the painters that first figured out how to do almost photoreal faces in painting.
Right.
Because they knew things.
They figured out things.
They figured out subsurface scattering in the 1600s.
Yeah.
Right? You know, if they'd written down what they were doing, you know, in a reproducible way, you know, we could have gotten there so much faster in computer graphics. We had to kind of rediscover all of these things.
Yeah. And I think that's a part of the issue, I think, is you know, part of the inspiration is I think that individual studios are rediscovering these things on their own and no one's providing a cohesive voice that people can go as a resource and say, here, by the way, you know, we've all been talking about this, but here's a resource.
So let's simplify and disseminate. And, and then just to finish the other point, which is that you think about, well, okay, so for a face, do we need skin microgeometry? Do we need forehead wrinkles? Do we need blood flow? Do we know all these things? You know, with computers getting faster, acquisition techniques getting better, and us figuring out ways to simplify it, at some point, it's just going to be pretty easy to get it all right, right? Faces have looked like this mountain that we might not ever get to the top of, creating photoreal faces. In 1999, when we built the first light stage, we literally didn't know what to do. And the light stage was just the only thing that we could think of that could produce some piece of the puzzle, probably, maybe, we hope.
Right.
And, you know, now we, I think, should be able to safely say photoreal digital faces that look indistinguishable from photographs or video, we are going to get there and it's going to be easy. And they'll have, you know, little velvety hairs for the asperity scattering and blood flow and microgeometry, and it'll be there. And at that point, once it's easy, why would you say, hey, let's turn it off? It's just like when I was an intern at Microsoft in summer of 92, we were just starting to get 24-bit displays, mm-hmm. where you, like, instead of having, you know, only 256 colors, yep. over your entire screen.
Sometimes you could use 16-bit. It was fancy.
Okay, yeah. yeah. You could actually have any color you want on any pixel. And right. there were folks who said, why would you ever need that? This is, you use three times as much memory, right. so that your stuff can look a little bit better, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out even the Apple Watch now on your wrist has 24-bit color everywhere. And your phones do, and your tablets do. Everybody does 24-bit color with full for red, green, and blue. Yeah. And they take three times as much memory to do it.
Right.
And they do twice that again for double buffering so that they right. can flop it in. And it's just a no-brainer because, hey, it's a bit better. And you know what? It's worth it to make that difference because we're creating imagery for other people to look at
right.
to communicate with them. And getting it right is actually valuable.
Yeah. And in fact, now we're even looking at the fact that high-end displays need to go beyond that, you know? As an example, right?
Well, so Retina displays.
I mean, in terms of color depth, right?
Oh,
so
color
now you're having
high projection
HDR projection and stuff. So there is always going to be something that's going to be better. And I think you're right. I think there's great room for exploration in this field. And I think that looking at things more scientifically what helps. And I'm not saying that artists aren't involved.
No. Artists, what happens is when we solidify the science of stuff, that just raises the platform on which artists can do their work.
Exactly. There you go.
And you know, you need a high enough platform if you're going to paint the Sistine
right.
Chapel.
I mean, exactly. And the thing I always say is like, you know, I can give my dad a Leica camera. Doesn't mean he's going to take a great picture with it, right? And it doesn't mean that my dad is not an artist. He's not an artist, but just because I gave him the most incredible data possible doesn't mean that he's going to make an amazing rendering out of it if he doesn't know how to render something properly or knows how to light something properly. So the artist's role to be an artist becomes important at that point, which like you said, we empower the artist to do so. So, all right. So with that, I think maybe we'll let the last bucket drop at this point. I really appreciate it, Paul. I think it was a fantastic conversation. We learned a lot about the history of everything that you've done, as well as where we want to go in the future. So it was really great.
Awesome. Fun time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye.
Do you remember to press record?